Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today's date is July 12th, 2005. Today's session is entitled, If God Can Be Found in a Burning Bush, Can Knowledge Be Found in Scaly Fish Pulp? Presented by Kata Schwinn. The number is SCK2005-02.
I also have a poetry teacher who says that a good poem should begin in the body and end in the body and make an arc through the mind so that that good poetry can do that for us. We're kind of living in an age where a lot of poems are becoming popular right now are ones that you sort of get to the end and you get it right away and you think, oh, that was nice, and then you move on and you never want to go back and look at it again. And so I'm going to put forth kind of a different version of what a good poem is, which is one that leaves you unsettled for some reason, that makes you want to go back, that makes you want to reread, that something about it maybe it irks you, or maybe it gets under your skin, or maybe, as Gail said yesterday, it makes you cry, or it makes you annoyed, or you think, I don't know what this means. Something makes you go back. And it could just be a line or an image. So today we are going to look at this wonderful poem by Elizabeth Bishop. Are there any Elizabeth Bishop fans here? Anyone? Yay! Fabulous. Okay, so what I want to do is read through it once, and it goes on both sides of your sheet. And then we'll do a little exercise and then kind of get into a close reading of it. Does anyone feel brave?
Oh.
Yes, wonderful.
At the fish houses. Although it is a cold evening, down by one of the fish houses, an old man sits netting his net. In the gloaming, almost invisible, a dark purple-brown, and his shuttle worn and polished. The air smells so strong of codfish, it makes one's nose run and one's eyes water. The five fish houses have steeply peaked roofs and narrow, cleated gangplanks slant up to storerooms in the gables for the wheelbarrows to be pushed up and down on. All is silver. The heavy surface of the sea, swelling so slowly as if considering spilling over, is opaque, but the silver of the benches, the lobster pots and masts scattered among the wild jagged rocks, is of an apparent translucence, like the small old buildings with an emerald moss growing on their shoreward walls. The big fish tubes are completely lined with layers of beautiful herring scales, and the wheelbarrows are similarly plastered with creamy iridescent coats of mail, with small iridescent flies crawling on them. Up on the little slope behind the houses, set in the sparse bright sprinkle of grass, is an ancient wooden capstan, cracked, with two long bleached handles and some melancholy stains like dried blood where the ironwork has rusted. The old man accepts a lucky strike. He was a friend of my grandfather. We talked of the decline of the population and of codfish and herring while he waits for a herring boat to come in. There are sequins on his vest and on his thumb. He has scraped the scales, the principal beauty, from the unnumbered fish with the black old knife, the blade of which is almost worn away. Down at the water's edge, at the place where they haul up the boats, up the long ramp, descending into the water, thin silver tree trunks are laid horizontally across the gray stones, down and down at intervals of 4 or 5 feet. Cold, dark, deep, and absolutely clear, element bearable to no mortal, to fish and to seals. One seal, particularly, I have seen here evening after evening. He was curious about me. He was interested in music, like me, a believer in total immersion. So I used to sing him Baptist hymns. I also sang, A Mighty Fortress Is Our God. He stood up in the water and regarded me steadily, moving his head a little. Then he would disappear, then suddenly emerge, almost in the same spot, with a sort of shrug, as if it were against his better judgment. Cold, dark, deep, and absolutely clear, the clear gray icy water. Back behind us, the dignified tall firs begin. Bluish, associating with their shadows, a million Christmas trees stand waiting for Christmas. The water seems suspended above the gray, rounded gray and blue-gray stones. I have seen it over and over, the same sea, the same slightly indifferently swinging above the stones, icily free above the stones and then the world. If you should dip your hand in, your wrist would ache immediately, your bones would begin to ache, and your hands would burn, as if the water were a transmutation of fire that feeds on stones and burns with a dark gray flame. If you tasted it, it would first taste bitter, then brining, then surely burn your tongue. It is like what we imagine knowledge to be, dark, salt, clear, moving, utterly free, drawn from the cold, hard mouth of the world, derived from the rocky breasts, forever flowing and drawn, and since our knowledge is historical, flowing and flown.
Okay, I love the ending to this poem. I just think it's killer and amazing, and it's just remarkable to me every time. However, if we started out the poem, you get to this huge conclusion that feels, I'm going to argue, really real and really true. But everything that comes before it is what makes that conclusion possible in certain ways. We get this really long, long, detailed description that goes on, and you're kind of wondering where it's going, and then it gets to this conclusion about knowledge. So what I want to do today during this class is to track really carefully through the poem and see what details are in there that are going to lead us up and make this conclusion possible. Does that sort of make sense? We're going to try to do it. Yeah.
I don't know Elizabeth Bishop. Is she from New England?
Yes, she spent time in New England. She also spent a large portion of her life in Brazil, actually, and Canada, right? And Newfoundland, yes. So, yes, that area was very much, landscape is very much a part of a lot of her work. She's probably, for sure, one of the most incredible poets of the 20th century, and so if people don't know her, I recommend her 100%. So we're going to start out. This poem has a lot. It's kind of long, and there's a lot of details, a lot of details, and it's hard to remember everything that's sort of going on. So because I know everyone here is really proud of their artistic skills, we're going to do a little drawing exercise. I'm going to break you up into groups. And each group is going to have a little section of the poem to work with. And in your group, I want you to do two things. One is that together you sort of, we're going to form just sort of a picture of what is going on in this poem so that we can kind of see what's there and get a better image for ourselves, because it's a lot about orientation and where things are sort of located and where's the sea and where's this in relation to other things. So I've done a beautiful job here. You can see laying out the landscape. We've got the ocean down here, and this is sort of the horizon line, and if people need to make a hill back here or whatever, that's sort of the layout. So I'm going to break you up into groups, and with your group, go through the section of your poem and pick out specific objects that are noted. And when you draw them up, you're going to draw them up here, or you can have one person from your group, or you can all come up, whatever. As you draw them, if you're feeling embarrassed, for instance, about your representation of a fish tub or capstan, you can also label what it is so that we kind of have an idea of that. So I want you to draw the objects from your section of the poem in here, and then also I'm going to give each group a pencil and underline any colors that are mentioned in your section. Does that sort of make sense? So that we have a sense both visually of sort of what's going on, and then we kind of will make a list of all the colors that are described. Is that everybody okay? So, you four right here are going to do the poem up until where it says, for the wheelbarrows to be pushed up and down on.
Can you see that?
Include the wheelbarrows?
Yes.
She's got
it.
Okay.
And
these four here are due from where it says, all is silver, up until where it says, with small iridescent flies. you three do from up on this little slope behind the houses through where it says at intervals of 4 or 5 feet at the end of that. Does that make sense?
She got it.
You got it? And you guys are going to do the rest of the room. Though there's not a lot of objects in the rest of the room. It's a lot of like big old dark seating. I'm not even going to worry about that. And let me give you a which can be rotated and around which the cable is turned.
So it's
going to bring things up from the ocean that they'll wrap around. Yeah. I expect a very detailed representation of that. And as soon as you guys are ready, feel free to come up to the board and start drawing. Everybody can be up there at once.
Thank you.
love the seal.
All right.
Oh, he's great.
Awesome. Wow. People are good here.
Maybe you can do
this with my bro,
so I think I should.
Raising his eyebrow against his better judgment. That was a great line.
Yeah. Shrug.
Are you on Christmas trees?
There you go, there's the fish houses. We'll let them draw that in. Well, he's not done with the houses. It's this group that has to draw the old man. It's the first group. Well, he's not done.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
Where is the old man?
It's that black spot there.
That bob right there.
You can change it if you want.
No, that's fine.
No, that's great. That's great. It really only has to be representational. It does not need to be.
I'm with you.
Someone should do a Pictionary game, but with poems. Wouldn't that be cool?
Yes.
She shouldn't
have
I hope you're not too worried about the house.
Why don't, while we're waiting for groups to finish up, those of you who have finished, toss out some of the colors that were in your section.
Dark purpley brown.
Dark purple brown.
Jagged rocks.
Yeah.
Go for it.
There you
go. Jagged rocks.
Oh, jagged.
You only had dark purple brown. Any colors? Did you guys have any colors in your section?
Blue
gray.
Gray, bluish, gray, blue, gray.
Gray. Wait, blue, gray, bluish, gray.
Clear.
Clear. Oh, clear and clear gray.
Clean gray.
Bleached. Gray. Bleached. Good.
That's still not bad.
Dark
silver.
Gray.
Dark gray.
Oh, it stains like dry blood.
Rusted.
Yep.
Although it's not a, technically a color, it's the icy.
Well, rust might. Could rust be a color?
Yeah. Crayon.
We'll say rust, even though it's rusted.
Could be rocks in it.
Anything else?
I think so.
Silver got it.
You already had black.
Black, nope.
The old knife is black.
Good.
Are they, is that where they are? Are we over there or are they right there?
Dried blood.
This is lobster plus the mask carried when the wild jagged rocks.
Any others? People can pull from other sections of the poem too if you're.
You get creamy.
Creamy?
Iridescent is sometimes. Mm-hmm.
Fish tub.
Yeah,
who's
somebody's got to spell that for me.
I-R-I-D-E-S-C.
Where? Down here, they're going to put it down here, they put it up the wheelbarrow.
How about clear? Is that now? Okay.
Yes, is that here?
Sorry, guys. You got blue gray. Mm-hmm. Glowing is glowing.
You know, that is an interesting question because by definition, we'll talk about this in a second, it's a time of day, but I always think of it as a, as a, that color.
Yeah, I think it's a place in the morning.
Yeah, it's not. It's a time of day. Maybe. But I think of it as a place. So what color do you think of it as? Like dusky color? Okay. And if anybody sees anything that, you know, one of your fellow groups has forgotten, you can feel free to call them on it.
Or redo it.
No, we're not going for quality, just making sure everything's present. Okay, groups, you have 1 more minute to finish up quickly. Remember, it can be a sketchy drawing with a label, too. We could have this picture then, like, printed on t-shirts for all of you, so you can always...
Our masterpiece.
We should
have a list of color grammars.
Awesome.
Yeah, I have something that kind of applies to what you're saying, which is my writing teacher always says, you can have a surprise at the end.
Surprising but inevitable, right? Yeah.
And so it's got to be set up, and then you don't have that.
What the heck was that?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
So I think we should.
Do you want a label
now? I resemble that.
Yeah,
sure.
I've
had that fan. I've had markers thrown at me in my teaching session. Masked. Good. See, it's good that he labeled that, isn't it? applause for this masterwork. For sure. Applaud yourselves. Applaud yourselves. Beautiful. Beautiful. Okay, so does this, I mean, so we have a better sense now kind of what we're dealing with. Or maybe a more distorted sense of what we're dealing with. So my first question for you is, where is the speaker in all of this? Is the speaker standing, sitting? Does the speaker move? Where's your sense of where the speaker of the poem is?
Speaker moves.
Okay. Where's one location where we have the speaker?
Talking with the man.
Talking with the man.
Where's the man?
I assume this is the man.
Yeah.
So I'm gonna do our speaker here in red, and we'll do it like a family circus with the dots, you know, showing where it goes. Sure. Okay, where else?
Singing to the seal.
Singing to the seal, okay. So then the speaker is down here. Well, it's not dots, but okay. Anywhere else?
She's at the slope behind the house.
She's at the where?
It says up the little slope behind the houses, so she must be living at that.
Right, so we go kind of... So, or at least his or we're going to go with her, even though the speaker is not necessarily Elizabeth Bishop. So her gaze is also directed this way, at least at one point. Okay. Where else?
Over by the ramp.
Over by the ramp, right? She's talking about. Okay.
But at the water's edge.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So yeah, where does the speaker end up?
At the water's edge.
At the water's edge, right? So this looks like a more flaming part of the water. So we'll put...
Is she really moving physically, or is she talking about it?
Okay. What do you guys think?
I felt like she was walking right down the beach and observing all this, and walked up to the old man.
Okay.
We
know for sure that she's near the old man at one point, and we know for sure that at the end she's at the water's edge. So at the very least, there's a movement there from sort of up above down to the water's edge. But at other points, the speaker's gaze is definitely traveling to different points, and as we watch the poem occur, our gaze is, specifically as we go through it, watch for how we're kind of pulled at times from our attention being focused up here, sort of on the land and the objects, and then we'll be pulled back down to the sea in a description, and we'll be pulled back up, and there's certain movements up and down that kind of occur throughout the poem. So as we go through, kind of keep an eye on that. Okay, we'll start going through, but here's our list of sort of words. Before we even start talking about the poem in general, is there any way that you would categorize these colors, like as a group, like a tone or a feeling, or what kind of things these colors are usually used to describe, or
age.
Yes, perfect.
Light.
Lack of light.
Or the color of the sea at different times.
Sea, okay.
Or cool. The shade as opposed to being a tint or a shade, being
a shade. A shade, okay.
They're very moody.
Moody, yep.
Cool.
Cool. So there's a sense that things aren't, that this landscape that we're dealing with is very much a part of the sea, that there's a sense of age, of moodiness, of sort of depth. We're not dealing with light, bright sunlight and things twittering around. These colors really are talking about age and depth and things like that. Okay, so let's go through this poem. So although it is a cold evening, down by one of the fish houses, an old man sits netting, his net in the gloaming, almost invisible, a dark purple-brown, and his shuttle worn and polished. Can you say what you were saying before about gloaming? Because I don't think everybody heard. Tell me your name again.
June.
Yes.
Just the idea of gloaming is kind of a dusky, not dark, but getting there.
Mm-hmm. And Ricky, what were you saying about it being a place?
Mm-hmm. Oh, I was just wrong.
Oh no, but I think that
I thought gloaming was a place. So that was wrong.
Okay. Well, I think it has that sense of here at least, that it is that that sort of time of day is almost taking over, and that the dark purple brown refers, what does that refer to?
Bennett.
What else could it refer to?
I thought it referred to the man also.
To the man, okay.
Well, the evening or the morning.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it most directly based on syntax does refer to the net, but that as you're, when you're talking about twilight and that sense mm-hmm. of setting at the quality of the light also seems to be a sort of purple brownish there. And what about this shuttle? Worn and polished, what's your sense of what that is like?
This guy's recent.
Oh yeah.
What?
Me too.
She made a picture. She made a picture.
Oh.
Well, just a picture of a shuttle.
Wonderful.
You know,
yeah.
That, well, there's two sides and then there's an indentation. And, or it, you know what I'm thinking of is a tatting shuttle, if you all know what that
yes.
is.
It's similar, I believe.
That's what I was thinking. It's similar to a tatting shuttle. And it's kind of this shape.
Mm-hmm.
Well worn and used.
But there's that polish quality, right? That there's that something that by that through its use
mm-hmm.
it's adopting this sort of glowing quality in its use.
It almost seems complicated.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think of something that's worn, but I think of kind of sort of like not shiny.
Right.
I mean, you got the polish in there. Just
but it does take on wood when you use the oil from your hands
mm-hmm.
does polish it
right.
over time. And it can
yeah.
be a dark polish. It's not like you polished it with glaze or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, but.
So definitely, I think you're both, I mean, there's a sense, though, that there's a contradiction going on there, that usually we assume things that are worn not with polish and glow, but with kind of looking battered and beat up, even though literally that is what happens, but feels.
Yes, we don't value
yeah.
the treasure that it becomes,
yeah, through its use. The air smells so strong of codfish, it makes one's nose run and one's eyes water. Where do you feel that line?
Oh, it's almost disgusting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is. It's totally. Totally. You can. It,
yeah.
All
yeah.
of a sudden.
Yeah.
You
can lay down on the docks and you can taste it.
Yep. And that first sentence, it's sort of this romantic atmosphere of the. Pretty gloaming, and then the
yeah.
nice, worn, polished shuttle, and then all of a sudden you get the fish in your face. It's definitely a wake up there.
I love that line. This old guy's down there every night. It's cold, it's dark. He does it so much that his thing is worn shiny.
Mm-hmm.
And the smell is part of who he is and
yeah.
what he does.
Yeah.
I was not disgusted. I was, my eyes were all watered, not because it smelled strong, because it was touching.
Yeah. So that line almost speaks more to who that man is and
yeah,
his
well,
character
and
his presence.
It sets up that ending, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. How? Say more about that. How does it set up the ending?
Well, what we're going, the ending of the... Do you want me to wait?
No, well, no, say it now.
This flowing and flown and historical,
mm-hmm.
the knowledge is that this old guy, this is who he is and what he is, and how he's come to understand truth. That's really abstract. That's why it's poetry.
No, I don't think that's abstract. He is sort of a concrete version of what we're going to
yeah,
encounter
yeah.
at the end,
yeah.
that sense of historical.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Ricky?
The other sneaky thing that this line does, and because everybody's had a visceral reaction to it, is that it makes the reader present. Even though she's saying one's nose, she could have said my nose, but she doesn't. And by saying one's nose, it's just a sneaky way, and having that real visceral thing that we experience physically,
mm-hmm.
all of a sudden we're there too.
Mm-hmm.
But it's real sneaky, subtle awareness. It's cool.
The other thing I want to point out before we leave the man entirely is this, the shuttle motion, what he's doing with his net, that there's a sense of in and outness of going, and especially, I mean, not as much with a net, but you know, when you're weaving or you're doing any action like that, there's a movement from sort of what's up and visible into the realm of what's unseen, and this sort of back and forth that we're going to encounter later as we move back and forth between the two areas on land. Go ahead, what are you saying?
It's like the seal.
Yeah, yep, this, we're going to, that's great. We're going to get to the seal who's also moving in and out of the water between where she can see him and where she can't see him, so.
This is also,
I have a question.
This is also something that's been played and replayed over countless millennia.
Mm.
So there's, you know, it was contemporary on one level. It's also ancient.
That's great. So there's a sense of timelessness just sort of in the mythic sense of time because he's doing something that we've done for centuries. That's great.
What do you do with this shuttle? He isn't weaving, though. He's repairing.
He's repairing.
So
no, I think you're...
That's different.
Yep.
Is that what it means to set a net? Is setting a net means
sits?
He's netting.
Sits netting. I don't know what it means to net. Do you know, have a sense of what it means to net?
Well, the guys that fish in northern Minnesota, netting means to fix your net.
To repair it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Or to make a net, too.
Yeah, or to make a net. I was going to say, it could be new or it could be repaired.
Okay. Okay. So the five fish houses have steeply peaked roofs and narrow cleated gangplanks. And narrow cleated gangplanks slant up to storerooms and the gables for the wheelbarrows to be pushed up and down.
Get the gangplanks up into the gable.
There's one there,
yeah.
Isn't there?
There's
one here. Yeah.
Not so much, though.
This one,
yes.
Yeah.
They're not connected to the gable. Go ahead, Gary. Yeah.
Yeah. Again, there's that up and down motion. Okay, then we get to all is silver, the heavy surface of the sea. Swelling slowly as if considering spilling over, is opaque, but the silver of the benches, the lobster pots, and masts scattered among the wild, jagged rocks is of an apparent translucence, like the small old buildings with an emerald moss growing on their shoreward walls. So what, we have two kinds of silver here being described. Can somebody talk about the difference?
Well, the silver of the benches is like the logs.
One is opaque and one is translucent.
Okay.
One is natural and one is man-made.
Okay.
And one is dependent, or at least more dependent, on the light of the day.
Okay.
And the silver of the water is.
And we're going to find out in the next part here that some of that silver on the other things that scales to that iridescence. But also just that the sea, that opaqueness, that the sea is, we're not being allowed to see through that, but that's kind of almost reflecting back at us, whereas on land, that translucence that we're being, that's a silver that's permitting us in, where the sea is reflecting back. What in general, because silver and gray come up all the time throughout this poem. What are people's senses of silver as a color in terms of what sort of feeling or mood it expresses?
Shiny.
Mm-hmm. But if we're gonna say like red is kind of angry and blue is sad and yellow is happy, what's silver?
Well, silver, I think, if you look at it as shiny, it can be uplifting. Mm-hmm. If you look at it as gray, it can be kind of in the doldrums.
Yeah.
So to speak.
That's both of those qualities.
Silver, though, makes me think, especially around water, makes me think of the flat. flash of silver you see when the light reflects off the fish, you know, when you pull a fish out or you see fish jump with a flash of silver.
So it's kind of a color that's made from something else, from its reflection on something else.
You also sort of think of things that are regal and wealthy.
Mm-hmm. Anybody else want to say anything about those lines? I realize we're...
Well, it seems like silver is kind of light, reflective light, and gray is kind of sucking light in,
sort of dampening. Yeah. Yeah.
It seems kind of neutral, or I don't know if neutral is the right word, but it gives off its own color, but it also reflects. And then I love that word translucence. You can see light, but you can't see what... All you can see is light. You can't see what's behind it. It's not transparent. It's not opaque.
Just kind of listening to what's been said, I guess I just get a sense of it's kind of a dangerous color. Like it's very... It's a moody color, depending on what it is at the moment. You can change quickly, think of things like very reflective and shiny matter, just something that sucks light.
And it seems like kind of what everybody's been saying at some time or another, it's playing on throughout the poem. We get sort of different versions of what sort of silver can be, that there are moments when it's playing its sort of mysterious card and other times when it's playing its sort of aging card. And I mean, that we go through all those sort of different versions of what it is and what it can be. The big fish tubs are completely lined with layers of beautiful herring scales, and the wheelbarrows are similarly plastered with creamy iridescent coats of mail with small iridescent flies crawling on them. So what do the fish tubs look like?
They're covered with scales. Mm-hmm. They're so thick that she calls them mail. Plastered on there. If you've been on a fishing boat and the guys have used it for years and years and years, they don't wash that off. It's just...
And does it, I've never been on one before. Does it really look like that silvery, shiny quality all over it?
Yeah. Just, you know, you see fish scale.
They get hard.
They get hard and dry and crusty, but they shine when they're wet.
That's great.
They're creamy. If I had to pick words, they were creamy iridescent.
Really? Yeah. I'm sure.
Good choice.
Yeah. I don't know where you got that from.
I don't.
It's brilliant.
Totally
brilliant.
Original.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And she uses iridescent twice, so it's kind of a double layer of both the scales and then the flies on top. And an iridescent, I just looked it up because I wanted the specific definition. Said, a lustrous, rainbow-like play of color caused by differential refraction of light waves, as from an oil slick, soap bubble, or fish scales, that tends to change as the angle of view changes. So,
I think one thing that line does almost goes back to what, I don't remember your name, but what she was saying earlier, by using the word one instead of my. Lots of people haven't seen fish scales do that, but almost everybody's seen a fly, you know, and would get that image that a little better.
Great.
Draws them in.
Yep. And that iridescent is this, it's not just silver, it's this rainbow-like refraction, so it's this way of also pulling in some of those other colors that we've seen into a kind of refractive quality.
I was wondering why it's jumps out because nothing else in the poem really is described like that. It's beautiful. It's, you know, we make our own
judgment.
You know, we're making our own feel judgments about this, and all of a sudden she needs to say beautiful.
Yeah. Does it remind you of any of the other objects that she's described thus far, though? That sense of beauty coming from something that's
that's a moment where she's starting to put her perspective of what we're seeing onto us to lead up toward that ending. Great. It also reminds me of that shuttle from the beginning, the sense that it's this worn object that she's, that sense of polish or glow. It's different on the fish tubs, but we have these sort of big, massive things that are also glowing with a certain, with this iridescent quality, though not because of use, because of the fish that have been. Well,
that's really important, yeah, I think. It's really important, I think. That is the first time she's made any kind of judgment about this stuff. I have been going all along, I'm thinking, well, I had to be. But now she says, and she does it later, too, when she calls it, where was it? Principal beauty, or do I remember?
Yeah,
and it's the scales again, the principal beauty. But not very often is it judgmental, it's just pretty much descriptive. I think that matters.
Yeah. Do you trust her judgment by this point?
You got me hooked.
Go ahead.
If you're the fisherman, if you're the old man, you might think it's beautiful. It's very lived with, it's like the smell of the fish, all of it is so happy.
Yeah. I think that's great. I think you're right. Both of you guys pointing that out. I hadn't noticed that that's where it first came in before. That's definitely significant.
And speaking to the audience of things that we really don't like, and I mean, tend to have really just all negative, like the smell of old fish and scraped fish and flies. Good Lord. That's iridescent. And I'll see that iridescent. But we make judgments that are made that kind of closes down to looking further. That's how I felt when I lived that part.
Would it be worth asking who, at this point, who thinks that's beautiful?
Sure.
I mean, I do. She's got me hooked.
Is there anybody that doesn't buy it at this point that the fish tub's actually beautiful?
Yes. A little bit.
You don't buy it.
Well, I think that at this point it's pointing out that we are spectators and that this is not going to be about the any longer. Anyone who has been doing a trade like that over time might see some beauty in what they do, but it's not the beauty like she's talking about here. Mm-hmm. I would be very skeptical that this man would look at his fish scales and think, gosh, that's beautiful. You know, he probably, you know, this weathered old man, like, what, your fish? You know, this is what I do. Mm-hmm. And I think that it is setting you up, that we're about to take this into a metaphor, into something bigger than the image of the man, or bigger than the man's own interpretation of what he's doing, but that it's sort of leaving that and going to get into something more metaphorical.
Okay. So that in some ways that's stressing that it's a position of a speaker that maybe is not living this life in the way that the man is, that she has a new, she has a new romantic version coming in. Okay.
I have trouble,
like,
if you just are doing it visually, I can see, oh yeah, that'd be beautiful, but I'm still smelling.
Yeah.
I haven't left that behind, so it's hard to be, you know, be as simple as say that's really beautiful when you're smelling codfish.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems to me that she's looking directly into the beauty of the scale itself, not the whole fish or not the whole smell, not the whole picture, but the individual beauty of small, separate things that create a whole.
So you are able to leave the smell behind then, for the sake of the single scale.
I guess so.
Great.
You know, it's unfair to quote Keats. He says, "Truth is beauty, beauty truth." This is just the fact. These are the facts. This is the truth of this picture, and this truth, stinky codfish and all, is beautiful. That's where I am as a reader, anyway. And I you know, the stinky codfish, I smell them too. Then they stink, but it's the truth, and that truth, which later is the knowledge, is indeed. I never knew what Keats meant until I heard that right now. Way to go.
All right, this is so great. We're going to keep going, folks. We're supposed to be done right now. Oh, boy.
3 minutes. I have to go get my children.
Yeah, please, as soon as people need, well, how about we'll say this, that anytime people need to go now. We're officially done, but if people want to stick around and keep going through, that I'll stay here if people want to keep discussing. I'm sorry that I have timed it incorrectly and we're not totally done. I think this is a
tribute to Elizabeth Bishop's being such a great writer, but
thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Up on the little slope behind the houses, set in a sparse, bright sprinkle of grass, is an ancient wooden capstan, cracked with two long bleached handles and some melancholy stains like dried blood where the ironwork has rusted. The old man accepts a lucky strike. He was a friend of my grandfather. We talk of the decline in the population and of codfish and herring while he waits for a herring boat to come in. There are sequins on his vest and on his thumb. He has scraped the scales, the principal beauty, from unnumbered fish with that black old knife, the blade of which is almost worn away. What's important in this section?
Sounds nostalgic.
Okay. And what is the old man, how does the old man change? Did it seem at the beginning, I guess I should ask it this way, does it seem at the beginning as though she's in personal relationship with him, or does he seem more like a piece of the scenery?
Yeah.
More scenery. And so all of a sudden, and this always kind of takes me by surprise, that because it seems like she's viewing this picture, and all of a sudden she's giving him a lucky strike, that there's this...
She's
there
for a reason.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And she's describing how she knows him. He's a friend of her grandfather's. That's why I thought it was a little nostalgic.
Mm-hmm.
If we're talking, if she's in Newfoundland, there is a decline in the population because of those declining stocks. And like everybody's moving to the cities, of Toronto or wherever, to get work. So there is a sense, just like in prairies that you experience here, there in rural areas, there's that sense of depression, sadness, and loss.
And so the sense of worn outness that we've gotten in all the objects is maybe not just use, but abandonment as well. That people are not there to use it anymore. Do you want to
say the old logging camps? We were talking about that this morning, but all the junk that's left laying. I mean, if you go out in the woods in Oregon, unfortunately, you know, you'll find stuff just left.
And old people are abandoned.
And
a way of life, like our grandparents, friends. We don't think our grandparents themselves.
Yeah.
It's, that's that value that lived out of me. Wonderful to be talking to our grandfather's friend.
Yeah.
What stories, what.
I can also sense like a difference of generation. I mean, kind of going back to when I'm saying. The way she talks about their, she calls them the scales, their sequins on his vest and on his thumb, kind of what you're saying about she's romanticizing, like, this is his generation of, you know, he's scraping the scale off a fish with a knife. And she's talking about how beautiful this is. He's just covered in scales.
Mm-hmm.
And I think about, like, friends of my grandparents, and I don't want to be offensive in any way, but we don't have a lot to talk about. I don't know, I just kind of sense like a difference in perspective. Like trying to be, you know, respectful and talking about the plant population, the codfish and herring, the voice, I don't know that they really care. It's not why they're there, it's just something to talk about.
So that there's a separateness between the reality that this man is living and the speaker's own reality, which,
yeah.
Though she's observing it, maybe she isn't actually a part of what's...
And she knows it, but it's not really her reality.
See, I took it the opposite way, that was a meeting of the minds in the sense that she's the generation that are leaving, and she's bummed about that, and
yeah.
Here's somebody who understands.
Yeah.
What it's like.
Well, and I think that, the sort of argument against that also is that she... Or not against it, but like Paul was saying, at the end we have this real understanding of knowledge as historical. And so even if she's not maybe in the same boat with this old man, there's a sense that she's in there feeling the sense of knowledge as a passage of time. So even if she's, if they're not in the same place, she is witness to that change, and I think does feel it deeply in that sense.
Perhaps it's her own mortality.
Yeah.
She's reflecting upon, but she's seeing this as what's coming. I get the sense that she's had this conversation before with this person. This is not something that just happened, because there's a certain familiarity that she has here, and that, you know, the codfish are going out, and this is the end of his time, maybe the end of his time, but it's also in her, it'll be the end of her time also, because she's not really the viewer as much, because she's very much involved with this. In reading this, I see it as, you know, she's a part of this landscape, the seascape. And but she makes notes that I've seen it days, many, many times. That,
okay. Great. Thank you. All right, I'm going to just read through all the way to the ending, since we're running out of time, and then we can sort of have at this. Down at the water's edge, at the place where they haul up the boats, up the long ramp descending into the water, thin silver tree trunks are laid horizontally across the gray stones, down and down at intervals of 4 or 5 feet. Cold, dark, deep, and absolutely clear, element bearable to no mortal, to fish and to seals. One seal particularly I have seen here evening after evening. He was curious about me. He was interested in music, like me, a believer in total immersion. So I used to sing him Baptist hymns. I also sang A Mighty Fortress Is Our God. He stood up in the water and regarded me steadily, moving his head a little. Then he would disappear, then suddenly emerge almost in the same spot, with a sort of shrug as if it were against his better judgment. Cold, dark, deep, and absolutely clear, the clear, gray, icy water. Back, behind us, the dignified tall firs begin, bluish, associating with their shadows. A million Christmas trees stand waiting for Christmas. The water seems suspended above the rounded gray and blue-gray stones. I have seen it over and over, the same sea, the same slightly indifferently swinging above the stones, icily free above the stones, and then the world. Okay, I'm going to stop there. What do people want to take from that section? Point out. I'll put out two questions. Interests me a lot. We have these two places where it's like she begins to say something, the cool, dark, deep, and absolutely clear, and then we have an ellipses, and then she breaks in with something else. So it's like she's starting to say something twice. I'm wondering what's going on there. Why does she interrupt herself? That's one question. And the other question is that up until this point, we haven't really had much religious, any overt religious stuff going on. And all of a sudden, if you look at, and a lot of times poets will break lines on places where they want to put emphasis on that word at the end of the line. We get music, immersion, hymns, God, emerge, and judgment as some of those end words there. So there's certainly a different sort of emphasis going on. So the question is, what's going on there religiously? And is her belief in total immersion, is that a religious belief, or is that a different kind of belief? Is that a more secular belief in a different kind of immersion? So those are my kind of two questions.
I was reminded of a line, and I'm sorry to do this, a Robert Frost poem where he's talking about the trees, and he says, "Truth broke in with all its matter of fact." And it's like she wants to get something philosophical, maybe even theological. You know, I'm going to say something about this deep sea philosophically. It's on, you know, it's eternity and all that. It's not bearable to anymore, but I can't go there. So I'm just going to talk about the seal and about my hymn singing. And then, because she comes back to it, doesn't she?
Yep.
Cold, dark, deep, and absolutely clear and gray, but I'm not going to go there again.
Yep.
And it's like, it's a different kind of truth. it's factual, and it is bearable and handleable, not so immortal.
So she's moving from one sort of effort at a certain kind of truth,
yeah,
and then breaking out of it into something else.
Can't go there.
Yep. But then at the end, I mean, I think it's important to realize that we don't hear cold, dark, deep, and absolutely clear exactly again, but we see her, or we have this if statement at the end of putting your hand into the water and tasting it. And so at some level, I think there's a final desire to kind of combine those two means of dealing with the truth, both that abstract sort of cold, dark, deep, and that other sort of truth. Okay, somebody else. What kind of, oh, go ahead.
Caught by the phrase after the second cold, dark, deep, and absolutely clear, where she goes to the trees and that the line bluish, associating with their shadows.
Yeah, say more.
I don't know what more, because then it's just like a million Christmas trees, yeah. You know, it's like waiting for Christmas. And then back to the water. I don't know what to make of that.
I don't either, but I had the feeling that this all blurs together. The shadow, it's not a distinct green tree, it's bluish like the shadow, and it all, and so too the water seems suspended. And that smacks of what truth is too, isn't it? It's blurry and uncertain.
And if these are literally a million Christmas trees standing, waiting for Christmas, if it is like a tree's farm even, and literally they're waiting to die.
Yeah, they're going to die at Christmas, aren't they?
Yeah. We always had done this in another class, and we always have an argument about whether some people are like, that's such a happy tone, the Christmas trees. And I always feel the same way, like, no, they're all going to get cut down. Like, I'm not sure.
Maybe that goes along with the whole town dying. Everything, I mean, obviously this person hasn't come back for a visit, since they talk about things happening over and over. They're getting ready to leave.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What's sure about change and mutability, and that the truth changes and knowledge changes. And
mm-hmm.
Well, and the trees die, and so do we, and so do.
And the associating with their shadow line, I mean, in some ways for me that reflects back to her conversation with the man, that it's an association with this person who's dying out, who's going to become a shadow soon, that the whole poem, you know, like what we've been saying, is about that sense of how do we form knowledge? How do we, if it's a historical thing, how do we keep gathering it up, and what do we lose? Okay. If you should dip your hand in, your wrist would ache immediately. Your bones would begin to ache, and then your hand would burn, as if the water were a transmutation of fire that feeds on stones and burns with a dark gray flame. If you tasted it, it would first taste bitter, then briny, then surely burn your tongue. It is like what we imagine knowledge to be, dark, salt, clear, moving, utterly free, drawn from the cold, hard mouth of the world, derived from the rocky breasts forever, flowing and drawn, and since our knowledge is historical, flowing and flown. I guess I want people to say everything they think about the ending. I did want to... It interests me that transmutate is to change or alter in form, appearance, or nature, and especially to a higher form. And it can also have to do with the conversion of base metals into gold or silver.
Ooh.
So turning a base metal into silver, which I think is interesting in light of all the silver we've been encountering in this. But so... what's going on in this last part?
Knowledge isn't cheap or easy.
What does it feel like?
Yeah, it's sometimes bitter and sometimes painful. But it gives the flavor of the seasoning. The light, less salty.
What about these ifs?
What the what?
Ifs. Like, why say, I've seen it over and over again, and then we get, if you should dip your hand in. We have an if, and we also have a direct call to you. Is is it a choice, I guess is my question. Is how knowledge comes to us a choice? How about that? My other question always is with the word imagine. It is like what we imagine knowledge to be. How does that change the ending? Instead of it is.
Do we hope that knowledge and awareness makes us get it, makes us understand that it's life and the big questions? We imagine, if I could just get one more little bit of knowledge here, I'll, now I know what life's about. And all it does is what? It screws up all the more. It's flowing.
And it can't be quite pinned down either.
No, it can't. And the image, if you ever had a bad injury, and what they tell you to do is stick it in an ice bucket, you know? I'm not talking just an ice on your knee, but if you stick your leg into 55 degree water, it's hot. And you can't keep it there. And cold is hot. It's painful like this, as if it were water or transportation of fire. Knowledge is maybe like that too. This is going to help me.
Jeez.
It's dangerous.
And sort of, to me, in there too, is this idea that, like, when the water is at this place where it's so much itself, this cold, dark, deep, and absolutely clear, when it's sort of perfect in its water sense, it feels it's so much itself that it almost becomes the opposite itself, that both of these things are contained in the, I guess, because I keep reading the burning bush thing, I kept thinking about that, you know, like burning but not having both of those things balanced at once, that true knowledge can kind of have, it always has to deal with both sides of the same things and hold them both.
The line about knowledge being historical, I think, is intriguing. Mm-hmm. It's because in that sense it's in the past, and that for us to keep up with things, to be in the moment, we have to, the knowledge that we did have has to be repeated. We have to, it's something that needs to be worked on constantly, not something, I know this, mm-hmm. because it's what you once knew, mm-hmm. It's not relevant for the now.
That's great. So that truth, we think of truth as being kind of universal and being able to cross time, but maybe the argument is that truth can be specific to a time and a place and needs to be relearned, sort of. Yeah.
So sad, because she's like, you know, this scene is gone. And, you know, she's trying to make a comment. I'm sad because she's saying, as she's doing that, she's saying, I can't do it.
Yes.
Is it gone? It's already out of here. This whole thing is out of here.
Is her book, did we ever send any of her books to the bookstore? Did you?
I think there might be our other books in the bookstore because we made the bookstore order when we were living here, and I think no one's bought it.
Well, I think there's one in the library.
There's one in the library as well. It's not her. The one that's really good is her. I think in the library is maybe Selected, but her Collected poems is just great and filled with awesome
take
stuff.
Other vote if there's Elizabeth Bishop fans in the room.
Yeah, are there any Elizabeth Bishop fans in the room now?
I've never heard of her before.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah. Well.
I'm thank you for introducing her. Yeah.
Oh.
Awesome.
She's, I mean,
yeah.
She's phenomenal. She's amazing. And the story of her life is pretty amazing too. She was lesbian actually, and spent all of this time in Brazil, but also spent a lot of her life being really horribly lonely. That was a huge, huge feeling, really, really isolated, and didn't like to teach, and was a very solitary person.
I think there's something like her, I don't know if her mom was like mentally
yes.
ill, and
yes.
then she got, I think, shipped to her relatives
yeah.
in movement, whether this
yeah.
God forsaken land.
Crazy place. Well, tomorrow, plug for tomorrow's session, we're going to discuss two other poems that have pretty intense endings. One of them is by Rilke. It's a poem that's one of his most famous, and the suspense is going to go now. It ends with a line, you must change your life. And there's a poem also by James Wright we'll look at, and it ends with the line, I have wasted my life. And so they're very short poems, so we can actually get through them, I think. But we're going to kind of look more at how do these poets arrive at these conclusions, and are they earned, and what's in the poem that brings us there. And I hope that you're convinced that all of the details add up to this ending for you that make it powerful. But thank you all for coming, and I'm sorry we went over time.